So, as we said earlier in the questions, we got all the way down to the arterioles, which were the smallest of the group, which would then take us into the capillaries, which would be the continuation. So, obviously, the artery side is red in diagrams, which means it's carrying oxygenated blood away from the heart. And, of course, that conducts blood out into the peripheries, if you want to use that term. Or fundamentally out away from the heart, where the vessels go from large to smaller and smaller and smaller. The smallest are the capillaries, and it is the capillaries where blood transitions from red oxygenated blood to blue deoxygenated blood. And at the same time, it's at the capillaries that oxygen exchanges into tissues or back into the, and carbon dioxide comes back into blood and so forth. So, capillaries represent the smallest of blood vesicles. Because they're so small, they're just the tunica intima. In some cases, a single cell defines the circumference. The idea is that as blood cells travel, red blood cells travel through the blood, when they get to the capillaries, the capillary is so narrow in diameter, they all kind of stack up together and move very slowly through the capillaries, which allows for a lot of time for gaseous exchange to occur. Of course, oxygen out on the arterial side and carbon dioxide back in on the venule side. So this lining at a small diameter allows for that. Average capillary length is about 1 millimeter, and the diameter is anywhere from 1 to 10 nanometers. So just big enough, again, as I said, to allow red blood cells to travel in single file along them, thus allowing for this exchange to occur. Most tissues are richly supplied with capillary beds, except tendons, ligaments, and articular cartilage. As we know in terms of clinical anatomy, of course, articular cartilage is avascular, so there's no vascularity to cartilage itself. But tendons are very limited in their blood supply, hence the reason why tendonitises are so difficult to treat, because without blood, you don't get inflammation. And inflammation, of course, is healing. So if you don't have a good blood supply to tissue, you're not going to get good healing. Hence the reason I said why tendonitises are so such a struggle to get healed. Ligaments the same. But basically, these beds allow a vast access to all cells of the body because any cell in the body requires metabolites, oxygen, also needs to get rid of its waste products, right? So this is why there has to be a connection between all cells in the body and these capillaries. The makeup of the capillary allows for gaseous exchange, and gaseous exchange in the body is known as internal respiration, which we'll be talking about that when we do the respiratory part, and exchange of nutrients and metabolites, as I said. So we can see here is our artery and arteriole here where we have the red side of the capillary bed, and then of course we see the blood, the blue side on the other. So we have, you know, as blood travels through the capillary bed on this side, it's losing oxygen to the cells to supply to the cells, and as the blood is returning back to the venule, to the vein, to head back to the heart, and therefore then the lungs for external respiration, which is the exchange of gases at the lung tissue, you know, it's lost its oxygen, hence the reason why it's blue. Now, there are types of capillaries in the body. There's actually three types. The first is called a continuous capillary, and this is the one that we find in skin, right, in skin and tissues. And muscles, and this is the type of capillary that causes the hyperemia when you treat someone. So these type of capillaries, they get vasodilated, lots of blood comes to the area, and you see that post-treatment as that skin getting red, colored, and having that redness happen as a result of the friction and so forth. They are named due to the continuous endothelial lining. And it would make sense that when we get down into here, there's only an endothelial lining and usually not much muscle. A little bit of smooth muscle here, there, and everywhere, and we'll talk about the reasons for that shortly. But we want just an endothelial lining because, again, what is simple squamous epithelium good at? Exchange, right, things to move across. So, therefore, when we get down to this, although we call it the endothelium, we call it that because it sits inside the lumen of the vessel. But it is, in fact, actually a type of epithelium, okay? And it is simple because it's one layer with a basement membrane, and this is what allows gaseous exchange to occur. So when we say that a capillary is down to the endothelial lining and a bit of muscle, it is, in fact, actually a simple squamous epithelium, which allows gaseous exchange to occur in both directions, right? Oxygen out on one side, carbon dioxide in the other, amongst other things. Within here, we have gaps of unjoined membrane called intercellular clefts, and these allow passage of fluids and small solutes. So the one thing we're going to learn in physiology is that, yes, we have gaseous exchange that occurs via this membrane, right? So oxygen leaving the arteries and going out into the tissues, and then carbon dioxide coming back into the blood system to be transported a number of ways. It's more than just one. Oxygen just gets carried by one way, and carbon dioxide gets carried by three ways, which we'll get to later, but just understand that. But along with that, because these are leaky, because of these intracellular clefts, we also get the exchange of fluids. Remember osmosis? So osmosis drives fluids all across the membrane as well under the rules of osmosis. Okay? Gases exchange due to partial pressure changes, and we'll get into that when we get to the respiratory system. In the brain, this type of capillary endothelial lining is complete. There are no intercellular clefts in this tissue in and around the brain. So there's no leaking that occurs in and around the brain, only gaseous exchange. Because there's no breaks in it and no leaking, this is known as the blood-brain barrier. The blood-brain barrier is so good, in some cases, medications can't cross it to do anything to the brain. So in the early days of medications for HIV, those with HIV, they were able to rid the body of the virus everywhere but in the brain. Because the drugs they use cannot cross the blood-brain barrier to destroy the virus inside neural tissue. So what would happen is they'd discover these treatments for HIV. Patients with their T-cell count would come back up again. They would be relatively healthy. They'd send them on their way, and then within 2 to 5 years, they'd have HIV again. Because the brain harbored the virus, which then would leave the brain and head out into the body and infect the body again. So this is one of the problems with certain diseases and the blood-brain barrier is getting medications that are able to cross that barrier and get to the tissues to help to affect change. So it's something that's considered when medications are created. So we can see here that here's our first one, our continuous one. We have a basement membrane here, as we know we have to have because we're dealing with an epithelial tissue. And we can see here we have the squamous cells here, just one layer thick, and then the lumen within itself. So again, we're down to just the basement membrane generally and this endothelial tissue. The next type of capillary is called a fenestrated capillary. They're similar to the continuous type, which had the intracellular clefts, but instead of those clefts, we have pores. So think of a cleft as a tiny, tiny hole, and a pore as a much larger hole. Okay? So we're going up in size in terms of how leaky these capillaries are. So somewhat a little bit leaky in the continuous form, a little more leaky in the fenestrated form. The pores are usually covered by a thin film or diaphragm. So there's a diaphragm there, and that diaphragm can be permeably changed at any given time. In other words, at times it's not so leaky, and other times it's very, very leaky, depending on what's going on and where you find it. So the pores allow this type of capillary to be more permeable to fluids and solutes as compared to the continuous type. We find these where there's significant need of absorption and filtration, such as the kidneys and the small intestine. Now, when you get to the kidneys next semester, which is, again, another kind of favorite organ of mine, there's a lot of filtration that occurs in kidneys, right? This is why sometimes your urine is clear and sometimes your urine is yellow. So it's allowing things such as water to either pass through or not, depending on how hydrated the rest of the body is. So Logan's going to be peeing pretty much clear urine with drinking a jug of water like that all day. whereas, you know, first thing in the morning, you know, it's usually quite strong because you've been holding into fluids and what you're getting is a less watery urine as compared to when you're drinking lots of fluids and have a more watery kind of urine. That's occurring because of these fenestrations that we find in the blood vessels that we find in the kidney themselves, along with some other major modifications that occur within the kidney. So we can see here we've got much larger holes as compared to just a little bit of clefts here. We can see again here, there's our minor clefts, and then we've got these relatively larger pores. Now, the last is the leakiest of all, okay? And they are known as sinusoids. They're so leaky, in fact, blood kind of gets stagnant. It doesn't move as well. So in the continuous and the fenestrated form, blood is moving relatively continuously. In the sinusoid form, there's still movement of blood, but it's deliberately slowed down. It gets kind of static in there. So these are highly modified leaky capillaries, and they're found only in the liver, bone marrow, spleen, and the medulla of the adrenal gland, which sits on top of the kidneys, right? So you only find them in those places. They have a large lumen that's very irregularly shaped. The lining is fenestrated and contains intracellular clefts. So we have big spaces in this form. So the sinusoid type of capillary, big spaces. Before I go back to the rest of the lecture, you can see how tight the continuous is. A lot more holes for movement in the fenestrated form. And then you can see these big leaky spaces between the endothelial cells. Very, very leaky tissue. This allows for large molecules and even blood cells to pass. This configuration allows for controlled sluggishness of the blood to allow for modifications to it. When you have fresh beef liver, how many people here eat fresh beef liver? Oh, people. Liver and onions? Yummy. Yummy with HP sauce. Anyways, have you ever cut a liver? Have you ever looked at a slab of liver? What's it look like? Yeah, dark, thick. Is it wet? Yes. If you throw it on the counter, is it bloody? Yes. So it deliberately is congested with blood. The liver is always congested with blood. And remember, the liver's kind of role is to detoxify blood, right? So when you are drinking too much alcohol on a Saturday night, your liver's doing all that kind of work to break down oxygen, because oxygen is a poison, believe it or not, a neural poison actually. And what it does is it takes that alcohol that's in the bloodstream, and the liver breaks it down by slowing blood down and then chemically interacting with alcohol to break it down. You notice how you always, if you have a night where you've had a wee bit too much, you wake up in the morning and you have this terrible breath. You know what that is? Formaldehyde. The liver actually converts alcohol into formaldehyde, and that's what you're breathing off. You're deliberately breathing off the byproduct of alcohol breakdown when you're breathing, amongst other ways of doing it as well. But yeah, that bad breath is actually formaldehyde. So we can see here these big, big, leaky holes in there. So with those in mind, well, I already used the term bed. So if we go back to this picture again, you know, it's always, the artists always have a rendition like this in the textbook where they have the red side and then they have the blue side. And as I've said before, blood naturally moves from the red side to the blue side within the capillary bed. And we call it a bed because it covers very large areas of interstitial fluids or tissues. And of course, as I said, you know, all the cells within there have contact to some degree with this network, whether that cell is taking on oxygen from the red side or whether that cell is giving off toxins and carbon dioxide as part of its byproducts of metabolism, one way or the other. So the artists always draw, you know, a little cute little picture like this, but you can imagine the significant amount of distribution of capillaries there are at any given time in the human body, because there's a lot of cells that one has to deal with. So it is an interwoven network of capillaries. It is the point of transition from the arterial oxygenated blood in the arteriole to the oxygen-depleted blood of the venule. So it's entering into the bed via an arteriole, and blood is exiting the bed via the close cousin of the arteriole, which is the venule. Right? Because it's on the venous side, we call it a venule rather than an arteriole. Okay? The movement of blood through the bed is termed microcirculation. So the fact that the blood's traveling through these really narrow, remember, they're only the diameter of a single red blood cell, and picture that red blood cells as they're traveling through are all lined up single file, kind of moving along one behind the other, again, deliberately allowing for this exchange to occur. There are two types of vessels within a bed. There's the vascular shunt and the true capillary. Let's talk about the vascular shunt first. You can see here in the arteriole, so the venule, there is one pathway that goes directly from one side to the other. Yes? Okay? Then there are other pathways that wind through a network that eventually from the arterial side get to the venule side. But we have this one straight through the middle. That is known as the vascular shunt, also known as the metarterial thoroughfare channel. And this directly connects the arterial and the venule by bypassing the bed. Okay, so again, you can see here, it's running all the way straight through, and that blood does not go into the bed. The rest of them are called true capillaries, and these are the ones where all the exchange occurs. So I have a thoroughfare and then a vast network. The terminal arteriole leads to a metarteriole, which is continuous with the thoroughfare channel. So again, we can sort of see it here. Here is our terminal arteriole here, and then our metarteriole is the one that goes straight through. The thoroughfare channel joins with the postcapillary venule that drains the bed. There are 10 to 100 capillaries found in any bed. What happens is, if the tissue is not demanding much oxygen, because it's resting, shall we say, the blood will travel from the terminal arteriole through the metarteriole directly to the venule. If the tissue is demanding a higher amount of oxygen, blood will still continue a bit across the thoroughfare, but will spread out into the true capillaries, thus providing the oxygen that the tissue is demanding because the demand's gone up. Does that make sense? So again, at times, you know, say you're working out, you're out for a run, where's the majority of blood going to go? Legs, glutes, those sorts of things. In other words, the capillaries in that area are opening up and the capillary beds are filling up with lots of blood, getting lots of exchange. What's happening in the gut? You're not likely digesting anything, so therefore you're having a lot more blood travel through the metarteriole, and because the needs aren't necessarily there. This is why, ladies and gentlemen, they tell you not to swim hard after a big meal, because you can cramp up, because you have a gut that's demanding vast amounts of blood because you're digesting food and you're swimming around in the water and the muscles are demanding lots of oxygen. This is where you get cramps and all those sorts of things, which if you're going for a run outside is not too bad. You can stop and sit down and deal with it. But if you're out in the middle of the lake in 30 feet of water and you go into a cramp, where are you going to go? Yeah, it might go down. So this is the reason why. Remember I said last week that if every blood vessel in your body opened up, you don't have enough blood to get around. So you'd go into a hypotensive state, your blood pressure would drop considerably, and you could die. So what's managing where blood goes and so forth are these capillary beds. Now, I said, you know, depending on the demand, the metabolic need of the supply tissue demands the percentage of the capillaries by required any time. So we have lots of them. So either blood is traveling through the metarteriole, directly from the arterial side to the venule side, or it is in fact traveling through the bed to meet the needs of the tissues. So how does that happen? Yep. What do you see here, 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 and here? Any idea what you think that is? Not valves. Yes, smooth muscle that act as sphincters. So when the tissue isn't demanding much oxygen, these sphincters will close and blood will only travel through the metarteriole. Now, some gaseous exchange can occur there, but not as much as if it travels through the whole bed, right? So the sphincters close if the demand's low. The sphincters open if the demand is great. So this ability to either open up the entire bed or close it down to the metarteriole is controlled by the precapillary sphincters. They open or close the pathways to the true capillaries depending on the need of the tissues at any given time. Okay? if you were out for a run, no, they have to be open because the run would have your muscles demanding more oxygen. So that demand would stimulate the nervous system to relax the smooth muscle sphincters, thus opening up the entire bed. Okay?
So, sorry, the bed is the whole...
Yeah.
The whole picture.
This whole thing is the bed. Okay? These is the metarteriole, and these are the true capillaries. So depending on the needs of the tissue, they're either all open, high need, partially or fully closed, no need. But the metarteriole never closes. There's always exchange across the metarteriole. It's the kind of the main highway. Yeah, right. So, no, the shunt is the metarteriole. Okay. So if the tissue doesn't need, the sphincters close. If the tissue needs, the sphincters open. Those are called pre-capillary sphincters. The shunt is always open. There's always exchange across for minor amounts of oxygen to still continue, right? Because if we completely shut it down, the tissue would get ischemic and eventually it would die, right? So we can't have that, okay? I mean, you have to remember when you teach something like this, you know, I'm slowing everything down and trying to, you know, for understanding, I'm just getting into a very small area to understand, but we've got, you know, stuff going on all the time, right? Your postural muscles right now are demanding oxygen. They're keeping you controlled and so on and so forth. I'll take both. Metarterioles. Again, it's one of those things that, you know, depending on what, if you're reading research or papers and results, it really depends on authors. That's why I get a bit picky about kind of knowing extra names, because at least, you know, if you're reading a piece of research, the research person might use the term metarteriole, or someone else might use the vascular shunt. It's just about you understanding. It seems a bit picky, but it does help you, because if there's two terms for something, then you're damn sure somebody's going to use one term and somebody else is going to use one of the other ones, right? Yeah.
But if you're going to, like, an overdrive, like, you said a run, you know, your
right.
Legs are requiring the blood, right?
Yep.
But then people do track a lot. Like, I don't know, like, do you ever get into, like, an overdrive? Or?
Oh, I don't know what you mean by an overdrive.
Like,
were you too much? Not particularly, because they'll shut down afterwards. Now, there is only basically one thing that happens that's very, very dangerous. Everybody knows, and you probably took it in first aid, if someone goes into shock. Okay, shock is a overactive immune response that causes through the chemicals histamine. For example, it causes all the vessels to vasodilate. And part of shock is you become hypotensive, and if they don't deal with it, you'll die. So it's an idea where, again, through chemical mediation, because of the reaction to, say, for example, an injury, a significant injury, or a heavy reaction to an allergen, where you get into this over-release of chemicals, which causes all the vessels to vasodilate, and that's where your blood pressure just starts to drop. Okay? Venous system. So we've got through the capillary. Now we're on the side that we're heading back to the heart. Please remember that from on the arterial side, vessels went from large to smaller, and on the venous side, they go from small to large because they're heading back. So the blood, once finished at the capillary bed, returns to the heart via the venous system. We saw that in the arterial system, the vessels got progressively smaller. Well, in the venous system, the vessels get progressively larger as the blood returns back to the heart. So we're going to start with venules, of course, that are the smallest, and head accordingly. So venules, approximately 8 to 10 nanometers in diameter. You know, they're kind of the same size as the arterioles on the other side. It's just that they're carrying deoxygenated blood. They usually consist of just endothelium, just like the arterioles. They're extremely porous. We have to remember, we talked about this last week, the tunica media on the venous side, more or less as compared to the arterial side. The tunica media on the venule side, is it bigger, the same, or smaller than the tunica media on the arterial side? Significantly smaller. Why? Sorry? Yeah, but there's something within the vein, so that doesn't need a big muscular wall. Why? Nope. Pressure. quite literally, at the capillary bed, the pressure of blood on the other side of the bed, on the venous side, dropped, and then continues to bleed off as it travels back to the heart. Yeah, and the resistance. Remember the pressure that's created. There is accumulated resistance as the blood travels through all those vessels, right? Now, on the arterial side, it remains high because you have this constant, right, systolic push from heart contraction. But on the venous side, that all gets bled off as it travels through all these capillaries all over the place. It's not, remember, it's almost zero by the time it gets back to the heart, but not yet. It's still a bit of pressure here, but it's going to start to really bleed down as it travels back. Kind of like these, not the capillary bed, but more the venules. So lots of venules that become very superficial. On the arterial side?
The other side.
Yeah. The venule side?
Yeah.
Okay, the blue side.
That is more, or
yeah, well, yeah, so if we look at the blue to the red side in the diagram, red is high pressure, blue is immediately low. It, yeah, there's so much resistance in there, there's a huge difference. Yeah, it just really starts to come down. So, so you know, if you can imagine, if you significantly cut yourself and you got relatively deep, what does blood do? It bleeds, but it just kind of wells into the wound and kind of runs over the edges, right? If you got deep enough and cut an artery, what would happen? Right? So right there, you know, your rate of exchange right there. So venule side, it'll just kind of ooze out. Whereas on the, and you know, even if it's a big vein, you'll lose a lot of blood. There's a lot, don't get me wrong. But it's not like if I cut an artery, it'd be squirting out across, you know, think of Monty Python, right? Yeah, just a flesh wound. Glad to see there's a few fans here. It's a long time ago, I know, but yeah. Did you ever see the Dan Aykroyd do Julia Child on Saturday Night Live? Okay, if you get a chance, does anybody know who Julia Child is? She's the mother of modern cooking in North America. She's my idol. She was still alive, right? I'd bow down to her. But look it up one day. Look at Saturday Night Live, Dan Aykroyd doing Julia Child. It's the funniest skit ever. Picture that he's cutting a turkey and he cuts himself and his blood's squirting all over the place. And it's quite funny. Anyways, so the venules are extremely porous. And as they leave the capillary bed, they become slightly larger and can have one or two layers of smooth muscle. So exactly the same as the arterial side, just not as thick. So right at the gaseous exchange area, leaky, thin walls, lots of ability for things to exchange. And as we start to move away, where we saw a reduction in smooth muscle on the arterial side, as they get smaller, we're going to see on the venule side an increase in muscularity of the vessel as we move farther away. But again, not as near as you see in the arterial side. Okay, so from venules, the smallest out of the capillary beds, venules come together to form veins. Now, veins, just the same as our arteries, have three distinct tunics, but the walls are thinner, the lumens are larger as compared to the arteries. So the arterial system is considered a low resistance system, right? Because they're larger in diameter, thinner walls, and so forth. There is little smooth muscle and elastin, even in the largest of veins. The externa is the thickest and most developed, and in the vena cava, the externa is further thickened by longitudinal bands of smooth muscle. So when we get to the largest vein that's almost to the heart, why wouldn't we have long, longitudinal bands of smooth muscle? Yeah, by milking it. So those long muscles actually milk the vena cava, because remember, our pressure is almost down to zero, so those longitudinal muscles help milk that blood to get back to the right atrium. Okay? Due to this architectural makeup, the veins can hold a volume of blood. In fact, veins are called blood reservoirs because at any given time, your veins actually hold 65% of that 5 liters that you carry in your body. Okay? Veins can have thin walls due to the much lower pressure of venous blood. The larger lumen, of course, allows for less resistance. To prevent blood, of course, from flowing backwards, so if we're in low pressure, like in the legs, for example, you know, right now standing here, my blood needs to get back to my heart. So in the peripheral veins especially, we have valves, just like in the heart, which allows blood to move towards the heart and then stop it from heading back down. It's a one-way valve towards the heart. So to prevent blood from flowing backwards, some veins have adopted what are called venous valves, and all these are specialized folds of the tunica intima. So they're actually made of the endothelial tissue, very similar to the actual tunica intima itself, just that they flap out and they're these one way. And we find the majority of these valves in the legs and arms. Anybody here got any friends that like work out like heavy duty, and you look at their veins and they look like they have these little lumps along the line of the veins? There's these like little lumps. Those are actually the valves. They're so well developed. Those little, you know, they look and they'll have this little kind of bump as you move along. That actually represents the valve. Yeah. So you can see here, you know, we compare the two, especially the tunica media. You can see here on the left in the vein, in red, very thin muscular wall as compared to a very thick muscular wall in the artery. It's just all to deal with the amount of pressures that run through the arterial side as a result of the heartbeat and so forth. Yeah. And it makes sense, right? If we have a fluid under very low pressure, the last thing we want are blood vessels that have a lot of resistance, because then we'd never get blood back to the heart, right? So we need nice, big, large diameter lumen, which provides very little resistance for blood to return back. Venous sinuses. Now, these are the coronary sinus of the heart, which we talked about when we did the heart. And I sort of relate it to something called the dural venous sinus of the brains. The brains? Of the brain. So it's this really flattened sac that sits in around the brain. Because, you know, we've got arterial blood that's traveling up to the brain. And then, of course, the brain gets what it needs. And we have venous blood kind of returning back. So you guys have probably talked about the carotids when you're doing SCM. So be concerned with that, right? So the common internal and external carotids are vessels that are bringing blood up to the brain. And, of course, everybody's heard of the jugular, for example, right? The jugulars bring blood away from the brain back to the heart to be reoxygenated. So these venous sinuses are somewhat specialized. They're very flattened, and they have extremely thin walls, like almost tissue paper-like thin walls. If they're doing brain surgery, they really try to avoid the venuses. They can damage them very, very quickly, very easily. They're supported by the surrounding tissue rather than layers. So the brain's been removed here. You can see inside the head, you know, we have arteries that will supply, I don't know if I have the arteries here or not. You have arteries that, of course, will supply the brain. And all this blue are all these venous sinuses that are collecting the blood after the brain's dealt with it to then head down the jugulars to get the blood back to the heart. So those two pictures represent the venous sinuses as they run through. These are very flattened, very thin-walled veins that exist. Yes. There is another sinus, I'll remember, in the heart. This is the coronary sinus on the posterior wall, which is returning blood back from coronary circulation into the right atrium. I already talked about anastomoses, correct? Right. So, veins, also anastomose. So when vascular channels unite, they form interconnections called vascular anastomoses. Most organs are supplied by more than one artery, and where the arteries meet, of course, they form arterial anastomoses. And as I said, these provide collateral channels of blood movement, right? So it allows for lots of blood to get to an organ. They also occur around joints, the heart, and the brain. Veins much more easily anastomose than arteries do. So you see a lot more anastomoses in regards to veins. In fact, if you look right down on your foot when your shoes are off in the summertime, you can see all these internetworks of veins all over the top of your foot, right? So you can see here in the arteries, we have a very large anastomosis around the knee, and this is one we'll be talking about shortly, and if you do need to know this. This is known as the circle of Willis. It is an anastomosis at the base of the brain that supplies the whole brain, and we'll get back to that shortly. Okay? So now we have some specific arteries that we need to know and some specific veins we're going to need to know. Out of all the arteries, only a few you need to know. So the aorta, of course, we've kind of a little bit talked about that it is the elastic artery of the body. It's the largest in the body. It's approximately the size of a garden hose where it leaves the left ventricle of the heart. The internal diameter is approximately 2.5 centimeters, and the wall is about 2 millimeters thick. So that's a lot thicker than you probably realize. That's pretty thick because of the amount of pressure, because blood is newly left the heart after a left ventricular contraction. It decreases only slightly as it reaches its terminus. There is that aortic semiluter valve, which guards the base of the aorta and prevents backflow into the left ventricle. So that aortic semiluter valve is kind of where the aorta starts, right? Think of that sort of in that upper part of the heart, the great vessel. Opposite each of the semilunar valves is an aortic sinus, which is a slight enlargement of this aortic wall. And within there are baroreceptors that regulate blood pressure. So baro, you've heard that term before, right? What measures pressures in the sky? Barometer, right. So because this is a part of here that's receptor, it's called a baroreceptor because it is, in fact, actually measuring the pressure of the blood at any given time as it passes by. So right at that area of the semilunar cusps, we have these baroreceptors. The different names of the aorta are named according to their shape or location. And of course, the first part is called the ascending aorta because it's leaving the heart superiorly. So the first initial part of the aorta is the ascending. The ascending aorta runs posteriorly and to the right of the pulmonary trunk. So you think of it going up and heading right. That's a typo. It should be to the left. I apologize. That should be left. Up and to the left. It always reminds me, whenever I do this, that sure reminds me of Seinfeld and the Magic Loogie. Does anybody remember that episode? No? Everybody know about the Magic Bullet with JFK? Right? So they did the whole thing, saying the bullet turned and everything else. Well, there's this scene in Seinfeld where George and Kramer are at a Yankees game and somebody spits and hits somebody, so they do this whole lecture how the loogie kind of turns and hits one person then the other, or whatever. Look it up. It's called the Magic Loogie. It's quite funny. So, up and to the left. It persists for about 5 centimeters before curving to the left to become the aortic arch. There are only two branches of the ascending aortas, the right and left coronary arteries. So quite often I ask a question that says, which of the following is the first artery out of the aorta? They have like a subclavian and all those sorts of things. It's not. It's the right and left coronary arteries. That's the very first blood vessel that comes out of the aorta. And of course, those are the ones that we talked about previously, which supply blood to the heart, both anteriorly, posteriorly, laterally, and so forth. Yeah. Sorry, I can't hear you at all. It's a Blackboard. Is it? Did I put the old one in by mistake? Oh, okay. It's just slightly different? Okay. Sorry, I'll change it. I'll change it after class or on break for sure. So we have the ascending aorta, the right and left coronary arteries. So now we've gone up. Now we're going to start to curve and head back. This, of course, because it curves and head back, is called the aortic arch. It lies deep to the sternum and begins and ends at the sternal angle. So think of where your sternal angle is. That's where the arch starts to head back. There are three major branches off the arch. The first is called the brachiocephalic artery. What's that tell you, that name? Brachio is arm, and cephalic is cephalad, remember that from directions, head. So the sheer fact it's called the brachiocephalic artery tells you that that's conducting blood to the upper limb, brachial, and cephalic head. So that's a branch that's going to supply arm and head. Okay? So brachiocephalic, and it passes superiorly under the right clavicle It branches into the right common carotid, right head, and the right subclavian artery, right arm. One vessel comes out, splits again, head, arm. The next vessel behind it is the left common carotid, which supplies the left head. And after that is the third blood vessel off the arch, is the left subclavian artery, supplies the left arm. What do you see there when you compare the three? What do you see in that pattern? Do you see a pattern there that's different? So you have a right and a left. The right, the vessel that goes right has to split to supply the head and arm. But the next one just supplies the head. The next one after that supplies the arm. So the right leaves as a single and then splits. The next one goes straight up and the next one goes to the arm. So you had a brachiocephalic, but you don't have a left brachiocephalic, do you? No. Right. So the right is a single vessel that then splits to the head and shoulder, or the head and arm, and then the next one just goes to the head, and the next one after that just goes to the arm. Why? I have no idea. Could be about structures and those sorts of things. Okay? And where it is in position, right? Because it needs to get back. So I'm trying to send, like, because, you know, because it heads this way, so why not have a single one and then split it off? Okay? So you can see here, where are we? Oh, I have no pictures in here. That's kind of weird. What did I do there? There's probably some good pictures in there. Yeah, kind of like that. I don't put any pictures in here. That's kind of weird. Yep. Oh, maybe I should go back to the old one then. I apologize. There's no pictures. If you follow this on the one that you've got, you'll see there's diagrams with it, right? Okay. So the thing to take away is first branch, head and neck. Second branch, head. Third branch, arm. Okay. The aortic arch and its branches supply the head, neck, upper limbs, and part of the thoracic wall. That's kind of what it's responsible for. So we've gone up, ascending, arched back, arch. Now we're going to go down. So once it gets to the back, it's going to start traveling inferiorly. When it runs through the thoracic, right, we can call it the thoracic or we can call it the descending because it's heading down towards the lower part of the body. So it runs along the right side of the anterior vertebral bodies of the spine from T5 to T12. That should be left side. Please change that. It usually leaves a slight indentation on the bodies, just kind of giving you for a little bit of information. Now, there are branches off the thoracic, off the thoracic part. Pericardic, which would go to the pericardium. Bronchial, yeah, kind of the branches and supply that area there. Esophageal, kind of the same area, but your esophagus. And posterior mediastinal, tissues at the back of the mediastinum. Right? As we travel down further, now the boundary between the thoracic and the abdominal is the diaphragm. So the aorta above the diaphragm is considered the thoracic aorta, and the aorta below the diaphragm is considered the abdominal aorta. There are branches off this segment, and they can be paired or unpaired. If you look at your next picture in your slide, you have, if you have the old ones, you can see all the branches. Yes? Okay, so paired or unpaired. The abdominal aorta begins at the opening in the diaphragm where it remains at the left side of the vertebral bodies. And then it terminates basically at your umbilicus where it bifurcates. Okay, so the abdominal aorta terminates at the point where the aorta bifurcates, dividing to become the two iliac arteries. And this is kind of represented basically at your umbilicus. So it comes down and kind of splits into the right and left iliacs, which of course are going to go off to feed the right and left legs. Some branches are paired while others are unpaired, and some branch off anteriorly while most branch off laterally to the right and the left. So you can see, you know, some of those supply the kidneys, some of those are the artery for the kidneys, some are for the abdominal organs and so forth. Yes.
Right. So it sounds like the abdominal is like on the left side and then when it's
bifurcates. No, it cut. So think of it, it comes down this side here, gets to the belly button, and then goes like this. Okay? And there are branches off that bifurcation, of course, that will blood supply to the internal organs here, bladder, uterus, prostate, those sorts of things. And then we'll again continue on. And when it gets down here, it's called the inguinal artery. And then when it gets down in here, it's called the femoral artery, and then named accordingly, tibial artery, anterior tibial artery, and so on and so forth as it works its way down. Okay? I can't believe I haven't got this. That's interesting. I may have to go to the open the other one here. Because I want to show you this. I don't remember not doing this. It's kind of weird. Okay, I'm going to go here, here. Oh, butter off. Give me 2 seconds here. There we go. Okay, so as I said, the circle of Willis is an anastomosis at the base of the brain. Yeah, it's made up of 5 pairs of arteries to ensure the posterior part and the anterior part of the brain's blood supply are united, which results in a vast amount of the brain being supplied. So believe it or not, when we see this, do you remember the vertebral arteries we talked about when we were talking about the frame and transversarium and wrapping around the pillars between C1 and C2 and going up through the frame and magnum, right? So this is the next part. So once that vertebral artery goes through and up, it then connects into an anastomosis along with the carotids to form a huge network at the base of the brain. It's made up of a set of 5 pairs. The origins arise from the pair of vertebral arteries and the pair of internal carotid arteries. The vertebral arteries unite at the caudal border of the pons to form the basilar artery, which gives off a number of paired branches to divide into the 2 posterior cerebrals. So here we can see, here are our 2 vertebral arteries, right, kind of coming up through the frame and magnum via those frame and transversarium. They come together to form the basilar artery. Branching off of the basilar artery, we have the 2 anterior inferior cerebral arteries here and here, and a bunch of smaller ones called the pontine arteries that supply the pontine part of the brain. Okay, so again, we have the basilar artery, which gives off a number of paired branches divided into the 2 posterior cerebrals. So up here, as we continue through the pontines, we have these posterior cerebral arteries here. So the 2 vertebrals, the basilar, to the 2 posterior cerebrals here. Everybody follow me so far? 2 vertebral arteries come together to form the basilar artery, which has its branches. And then the basilar artery goes all the way up to where we get a division into 2 posterior cerebral arteries here and here. Okay? Yes? Okay? All right. From there, we have the vertebral basilar artery system that supplies the posterior circulation of the brain. So the 2 vertebral arteries and the basilar artery going up to the posterior cerebrals, they, as known as the vertebral basilar arterial system, and it supplies the posterior aspect of the brain. There's a branch off of each posterior cerebral artery that travels to the internal carotids, and it's called the posterior communicating artery. Of course, there's 2 of them. 2 vertebrals come together to form the basilar, then splits to perform the two posterior cerebrals. Then there is a communicating artery between the posterior cerebrals and the internal carotids. So we can see there's 1 here on one side and 1 on the other. So we have a communication between the internal carotids and the posterior cerebrals via the posterior communicating arteries. you are actually going to do a vertebral artery test at some point to determine whether or not there's any kind of blockage to here that can result in problems for the patient. Yep. There's a branch. So there are two branches off of each internal carotid, the ophthalmic artery and the anterior cerebral artery. So there is the ophthalmic here and the anterior cerebral artery here. So here's the posterior cerebral. Here's the anterior cerebral. Okay. There's a branch which also connects the two anterior cerebral arteries, which is called the anterior communicating artery, which we can see here. Okay. What's important to understand is, my ex, her brother-in-law was watching TV one night, and he thought things were kind of funny. So he closed his left eye, and he could see the TV okay. And he closed his left eye, could see okay. Closed his right eye, and he's totally blind. Couldn't see out of it. What had happened was, he actually got a blood clot in his left internal carotid. And it went and affected ischemia to the occipital part of his brain, and he couldn't see because sight is in the occiput. Okay? So he went in. Of course, you can imagine, bit of an emergency, got a massive clot in the carotid. Oh, my goodness, what's going to happen to the guy? So I thought surgery for sure, not at all. They didn't want to. The artery or the occlusion of the clot stayed in there and eventually got his sight back again. Why? No, it didn't pass. It's still there to this day. What's that? Because of this anastomosis, blood went the other direction, and it fed the brain. So it's almost like the body has this ability to create anastomosis, which protects the brain if something happens at any point, because you can see they all feed each other. So one gets blocked, they're going to get fed from somewhere else. Oh, I thought you heard something on the news that the road's closed on the highway. I'm like, what? Yeah, there's bypasses. There's. Yep. Right, right. It's called a berry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And of course, you've been checked, right? Absolutely, they're genetic as hell. You should be checked. They're genetic.
Oh, they didn't say that. We asked the
urologist. Berry aneurysms are genetic. Interesting.
They said no.
Interesting. Well, the thing is, you know, it's one of those things, okay, they find it. They're not going to do anything to it. It didn't burst. They're not going to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
No, they did. Because you were
trying to find it. No, if they did you and they said, oh, you've got a couple of berry aneurysms there, they're not going to do anything with them anyway. So do you really need to know?
Yeah.
Right, at the end of the day?
I mean,
right. Okay. Now, with this gentleman, they were afraid if they went in and tried to scrape out that artery, they'd loosen that clot, and then things could get far worse. So they just left it there, and he's still alive and doing fine. His vision isn't perfect, but it's ultimately there. And what saved him was because of this entire anastomosis. This is actually fundamental anatomy. I know right now you're like, what? But in past class, this is going to come up quite a bit. But it is a very unique part of that blood vessel that you do need to know for sure. Cerebral artery. So the anterior cerebral supplies most of the medial and superior surfaces of the brain and frontal lobe. The middle cerebral artery supply the lateral surface of the brain and the temporal pole. The posterior cerebral arteries supply the inferior surface of the brain and the occipital pole. Fundamentally, these small little arteries that come up out of this vertebral artery and these two internal carotids basically supply the entire brain. Anything that gets occluded here and blocked, you've got a problem. This is actually a 3D PET scan of an actual brain and colorized, and this is what it looks like. This is actually, I know it doesn't look as perfect as what you saw in the drawing, and they never do. There's your two vertebral arteries there, and then there is your basilar running through with all its branches, and then, of course, there's your posterior cerebrals, there's your posterior communicating there, there's your two internal carotids and so forth. And you can see how they branch out and form this entire network. Fundamentally, arterial blood supplies the brain superficially, and venous blood drains the brain deeply, which is entirely backwards to wherever else in the body. And remember, with those capillaries, the continuous, they have no clefts and nothing can pass through into the brain because of this barrier of this endothelial tissue. Basically, the arteries run on the outside of the brain and drive in, and then the veins tend to be deep and come out the drain. They're superficial ones too, don't get me wrong. But therefore, we can say that the cerebral circle, arterial circle, the circle of Willis, is an important anastomosis of the base of the brain between four arteries that supply the brain. The posterior cerebral, posterior communicating, internal carotid, anterior cerebral, and the anterior communicating. Yeah. Basically, these give rise to smaller branches, which of course go off and will supply the whole brain. And that's all you need to know about it.
Perfect. Thank you.
Welcome. The next is the facial artery. It arises between the hyoid bone and the base of the mandibles. It winds its way in front of the external carotid from which it originates. The facial artery winds its way forward and upwards towards the submandibular gland, passing on to the face where its pulse can be felt as it crosses the mandible. The reason I put it on here is because this is one of the pulses you need to know, correct? You did this in lab? You did the facial artery pulse in lab? Yes, that's why I put it up here, so you have an idea where it is. You didn't? You guys didn't palpate the facial artery? It's not there? I must have too many versions. Don't worry, I'll clean it all up. You'll get it. Huh. You don't think you palpated it? Right there. There's the, see the facial here? Right? So sort of right here at the chin. So you come in right here. You did this one, right? Right here. Yeah. Gain the temporals up here. Yeah. Not carotid. Facial. Carotid's in here behind SCM. Facial's right here. It comes over the outside of the mandible by masseter. There's a small artery there too. You did that one? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Might be on UOP. Pulses are on UOP. Okay. Due to its superficial course, the pulse of the facial artery is palpable at the anteroinferior angle of the masseter muscle against the bony surface of the mandible. Subclavian, that's the next one. There are a pair of large arteries in the thorax that supply blood to the thorax itself, head via the vertebral arteries, neck, shoulder, and arms. The right subclavian is located below the clavicle. It branches off of the brachiocephalic, right? Remember the brachiocephalic went right and then it broke into the subclavian and the carotid, correct? Okay. This left subclavian branches off of the arch itself. It ends at the first rib's lateral edge. At this point, it turns into the axillary. Please remember, it's the same artery. It's just named differently where it is anatomically in the body. So the subclavian is called subclavian because it over the first rib below the clavicle, right? And then as it leaves there and gets over to here, it's the axillary, then the brachial, and it's only because of where it is. But please remember, large to smaller and smaller and smaller, right? Because it's an artery. Okay? And it passes between the anterior and middle scalenes. What did I say about this? It can cause something called thoracic outlet syndrome, right? If the anterior middle scalenes is tight, guess what it's going to do? It's going to squeeze it. And you're going to learn a test and assessments. You put the arm in a particular position and the patient's head, and the pulse will disappear if they've got it. It'll actually squeeze off the artery, and they'll lose pulse, and their fingertips will go tingly and feel funny. If you think you have it, you're going to do this test to see if it's positive. It's likely they have it. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, correct. Yeah. Yep, yeah, it can happen. Brachial artery. Why should I ask, get you guys up here to show me if you can palpate and see where it actually is? Where do you palpate, or how do you palpate the brachial artery?
I can feel mine right now.
Yeah, under here. You want to be up a bit higher.
I can never get mine either.
Okay, how were you taught to palpate arteries?
Is it like your elbow? And then
yeah. How were you taught to palpate an artery?
Oh.
Whenever you palpate an artery, what's it doing? You push firmly and you slowly release, right? Because you don't want to be like the blood pressure cuff and actually, right? Because what you're feeling is that, you know, that ripple traveling through from every heartbeat, right? So that's the idea of it as far as that goes. And feel with your fingertips. It's there.
I was talking to a nurse and they do it like here.
Yeah, that's not the antecubital once it gets there. It's where you put your cuff. So quite often I see students, they actually put their cuff all the way down here into the antecubital space, right? Eh. What can happen? What's happening here? You have the biceps that does this and then it drops into a hole. If you put the cuff there, what are you doing? Right. That cuff should be up here, and that arrow or that line should be right along that brachial artery here. So you have space here, lots of... How many people here put their stethoscope on and it's tucking underneath the cuff? Yeah,
like,
get the cuff up, get it out of the way.
Okay,
you shouldn't.
You didn't have to. Okay.
Does anybody have their cuff with them?
No,
I'd show you. Maybe on break I'll show you how to do it. Yeah, don't tell Michelle or whoever I told you how to do it, because I can do it with one hand. With my other hand holds the stethoscope. Oh, God, it's thousands of them. But yeah, I don't like the cuff down here with your bell underneath, because then you're right, well, it's like, oh my God, like, yeah, because you're hearing rubbing the cuff and all those sorts of noises, right? Get the cuff up, then do it. Yeah, if you can grab one, a break, bring it, I'll show it to you. Okay? But the thing to remember here is you have to understand it runs underneath biceps brachii, right? Arteries run deep for protection, right? Because the body knows they're kind of vulnerable. So it actually runs a little underneath biceps here. When you get down here, you're actually getting into the cubital artery, which will be antecubital artery, which will be basically fold into the radial or the ulnar arteries themselves. So, you know, quite often you can do it here, but most of the time I like to see it, you know, you can do it right around there. If you're getting way up here into the belly, you can do it there, because what you're trying to do is get the line on your cuff to run along that line of the artery, right, as far as that goes. Radial ulnar arteries, smaller branch of the brachial bifurcation and a direct continuation. So the radial artery basically runs perfectly straight from the brachial artery to that side of the hand, okay? Radial is always lateral, and ulnar is always medial. So radial, medial, or ulnar, right? Radial, ulnar, in the anatomical position. So radial is always lateral, ulnar is always medial, okay? So the radial, the reason you take the pulse on the radial artery is because it runs such a straight line. There's no kind of way for it to go. Hence the reason why. So we say it's smaller branch, direct continuation to the hand, hence the reason for the pulse. It enters the wrist on the lateral side where it bifurcates into a superficial and deep branch, which then eventually anastomoses with the ulnar artery. So the ulnar and at the brachial, it divides into the radial artery and the ulnar artery. And by the time both the radial and the ulnar get to the hand, they anastomose in the hand. Okay. The ulnar artery is the larger of the two. It passes along the medial border of the forearm into the wrist, where it bifurcates into superficial deep branches, and it, as I said, anastomoses with the radial artery. The anastomoses created by the radial ulnar and the ulnar arteries is known as the palmar arches of the hand. So here is your radial artery traveling here, and you can see that nice straight line, hence the reason why we take the pulse on the radial. And then here is the ulnar coming off, and you see it has to make a bit of a twist and turn. And then we have a superficial branch here for the superficial palmar artery, and then we have the deep palmar artery here, basically an anastomosis between the radial and ulnar arteries in the hand. Okay? Femoral artery, it's large in the thigh and the main arterial supply to the lower leg, or the thigh and leg. It enters the thigh from behind the inguinal ligament as a continuation of the external iliac artery. Here it lies midway between the anterior superior iliac spine and the symphysis pubis. So you can see it running right along here. You can also see it. There's your inguinal ligament there. So we're into the iliac artery here, and then below the inguinal ligament, it then becomes the femoral artery, which we see runs quite deeply, deep into the thigh in here. In fact, when people are in terrible trauma and maybe dying in the trauma room, physicians don't look here or here for a pulse. They go here for a pulse. Right, that's because it's a very large artery that's accessible, and that's what they'll search for a pulse in any given patient who is really, really struggling and having an issue. Dorsalis pedis. Now, this is you. I don't think you will learn this yet. You will learn it next semester. This is a pulse that's in the foot, and you will need to learn it. Dorsalis pedis artery, or the dorsal artery of the foot, it's a blood vessel of the lower limb that carries oxygenated blood to the dorsal surface of the foot. It arises at the anterior aspect of the ankle joint and is a continuation of what is called the anterior tibial artery. It passes from the ankle joint along the tibial side of the dorsum of the foot to the proximal part of the intermetatarsal space. There it divides into two branches, the first dorsal metatarsal artery and the deep plantar artery. Along its course is accompanied by a deep vein, the dorsalis pedis vein. The extensor hallucis longus and extensor digitorum brevis and longus tendons can also be located close by. We'll be learning all those next semester. So you can see it right here. We've got it coming down here to the tibial that becomes dorsalis pedis on here. It's a very important artery. It signifies if there's loss of blood supply to the lower limb due to any kind of injury up higher. So you can have what's called compartment syndrome, where the muscles in the lower leg become very inflamed and they swell. But because they're in such a tight compartment, they actually squeeze off the blood supply. So the patient, of course, will express coolness or coldness, numbness and tingling. Then you'll have to palpate this artery to see if there's an actual pulse in there that may let you know that there might be an anterior compartment syndrome going on, off to the hospital, to medical emergency. To make sure that there's blood supply getting down to the foot. Yeah.
I wasn't sure, so I had some patients with feet, and I was just trying to get that thing all the way, hoping for better, but it would be possible that
it's possible. More likely, shin splints, everybody probably knows what, some degree. Shin splints can cause the muscle to get so inflamed and swollen in there, it actually squeezes off the tibial artery and diminishes blood supply to the foot. Mm-hmm. Common with jumping. Yes.
Like Raynaud's
is, that's more the ulnar and radial arteries, and that's a spasming pathology. So the artery is actually vasospasm cutting off blood supply to the hand. You can have it forever for all your life.
Yeah,
you can either just have it or it can be associated with diseases like rheumatoid arthritis.
Right.
Yes.
So bad that it.
Oh, you'll be able to look at someone's hand and have a perfect line of white.
Yeah, but isn't it usually too, like you have to get amputations because of the tissue
time? Only if it gets really, really bad.
Right.
That's really significant.
I've seen it.
Have you? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe I'll finish the veins. Let's finish the veins. There's not many to do, and then we'll take a break. Then blood vessels will be done, okay? On break, I will do so, yes. Yeah, there's not as many veins. So, of course, we talked about specific arteries. Now we have our specific veins. Remember that veins return blood back to the heart, and of course they start small and get large as we go closer to the heart, right? So the first is the inferior vena cava, which of course collects most of the venous blood from the organs inferior to the diaphragm, as well as the lower limbs as well, of course. And it passes through the diaphragm to enter into the posterior heart at the right atrium. So we can see it coming up. It kind of follows along the aorta, fairly large size vessel. So the aorta would be over here a bit to the left, and then the vena cava would be to its right to some degree. Here is a reminder, here's your inferior vena cava here heading into the lower part of the right atrium. The superior vena cava, of course, receives blood from the upper limbs, those tissues above the diaphragm, and the head and neck. And, of course, it connects at the posterior aspect of the right atrium. So, again, here we see nicely our diaphragm is here, our inferior vena cava coming up here. And, again, we've got common iliacs. As you can see, if you remember, you know, you saw the picture of the aorta, it looks pretty darn the same, doesn't it, right? Same size, kind of follows right along. And you'll always find that. Everything gets paired up, right? Where you find an artery, you're going to find an associated vein kind of following the same pathway, right? And remember those triangles we talked about? Remember the suboccipital triangle and so forth? Well, that's why they travel side by each, because they both use those triangles and foramen that are created by the body to wind their way through to get to where they need to go. So again, here's your superior vena cava here on the right, coming down to the upper part of the upper posterior part of the right atrium, again, draining blood from head, neck, shoulders, and arms. We have the internal external jugulars. So the internal starts with the jugular foramen, which descends parallel to the carotid and receives blood from the cerebral sinuses. Remember those foramen you have to learn at the base of the skull in clinical anatomy? Okay, that's the one of them. What's that? Yeah. No, but remember you had the jugular foramen. So that's the internal. Now the external is considered a superficial vein of the head and neck. The facial vein drains into the external jugular. There is an anastomosis between the internal and external jugular veins at the angle of the mandible, which provides dual venous drainage of the face, scalp, and cranium. And the external jugular descends towards the test, just deep to the skin on the anterior surface of the SCM. So you can see it right here. Here is your internal jugular that we can see here. And then we have, of course, our superficial temporal here. Our external jugular kind of here. And you can see they drop down into the subclavian vein. Same as the subclavian artery, only it's a vein. So they're named very similar. They're in very similar areas. In the leg, we have a couple we need to deal with, because we do look at some pathologies with the blood system. That's the reason why you need to know these. The great saphenous, which ascends along the medial aspect of the leg and thigh, it drains into the femoral vein near the hip. And the small saphenous, sometimes called just the saphenous, arises from the dorsal venous arch of the foot and ascends along the posterior and lateral aspects of the calf. So here is your great saphenous here, called great because it's so long. And then your small saphenous or saphenous is much shorter that we see running here. And then there's the deep vein of the leg. It is these two that are the most common vessels for something called varicose veins. Everybody, I'm sure, has heard of varicose veins. Okay, so this is the result of the weakening of the walls of the veins near the valves, and they've weakened or become stretched, and they no longer function properly. And because they don't function properly, we have retrograde movement of blood heading back to where it came from, and it pools. So we say the valves may not work properly, blood then pools in the veins, and the vessels become grossly distended. Another form of a varicose vein is a hemorrhoid. Yes? Yes. It's a couple of different ways to fix them. I'll get to those in a minute. Okay. One other thing. Ladies, why are ladies more prone to hemorrhoids than men? Yes. So the fetus pushes on the venous system and you get buildup of pressures in around that anal area and in the leg. And that builds up a pressure. Remember, they're thin-walled. Higher pressure would result in distension of the vessels. So they can look like that. Right? So what's happening is you have your normal valves here. The valves break. You get congestion of this retrograde blood, and it pools into these massive veins that we see there. Okay. Take a break. So you want... So, we talked about all this stuff, heart, blood vessels. That's not my remote. but we did talk about, you know, how it moves this stuff. And that's our last part here that we need to talk about. it's the actual blood itself that this cardiovascular system moves around the body. So what the heck is blood? Right? See here, you know, we all have a sense of it. What kind of tissue is it? Why? If we look at our definition of connective tissue, it's about cells and matrix, right, as compared to epithelial tissue. So the fact that blood has cells in it but has a liquid matrix, it defines or falls into the connective tissue category based upon that. So it's a connective tissue that consists of cells surrounded by a liquid extracellular matrix. This liquid matrix is called the blood plasma. Now, when we look at the fact that our tissues are wet and they're surrounded by fluid, which we call interstitial fluid is created by the fluids in blood itself. So interstitial fluid is the fluid that surrounds body cells and is consistently renewed by blood. Remember how the capillaries were leaky, right? Temperature of blood is 38 degrees, which is basically a degree higher an oral or rectal thermometer, so blood's a little bit warmer. It's slightly alkaline, 735 to 745. Now, I know artists in books draw blood either blue or red, depending on oxygenated or deoxygenated. It is, in fact, either bright red or dark red. So if it's fully saturated with lots of oxygen, it's very, very bright red. If it's sort of deep venous blood that's not that oxygenated, it's almost a maroony kind of color. It's much, much deeper in red. And I've seen patients who are in traumatic situations, and when that blood starts coming out of a wound, everybody kind of panics because it's very deep blood that's coming out of very deep tissues and could be very dangerous for the patient. It constitutes 8% of your body mass. You have 5 to 7 liters in the average adult male and 4 to 5 liters in the average adult female. Fundamentally, basically, we say somewhere in the neighborhood of 5.25 liters on average for human beings to have. Again, think of 5 1/4 bags of milk. Does anybody drink milk anymore? Cow milk? Milk? I haven't drank cow milk in 40 years. Yeah, no, I haven't drank cow's milk in forever. I can't. I drink soy milk and all that kind of stuff. I don't actually drink soy. I drink, why is this not working? What's going on here? What's going on here? There we go. Okay, so within that context then, we have this liquid matrix and we have solids. So therefore we can say blood has two components to it. It has the blood plasma, which is the liquid, so watery liquid, which is an extracellular matrix that contains salt dissolved substances, minerals, vitamins, so on and so forth. And it has a solid part called elements, or formed elements. So the blood plasma represents the liquid part of blood, and the formed elements represents cells and cell fragments, which is the solid part of blood. Blood is 45% solid and 55% liquid. And when we take a blood sample and centrifuge it by spinning it and forcing things to move, what you get is the liquid at the top and all the elements, the solid, in the bottom. So the liquid represents the plasma. The little clear area here, blue here in this picture, represents white blood cells and platelets. And then the very bottom, this deep, deep, dark red area, represents the red blood cells we find in the blood. So when we centrifuge it, we actually can separate the liquid from the solid components of blood. The plasma, of course, is straw-colored liquid, which we can see here, kind of that straw color. It's approximately 92% water, 9% solutes, proteins known as plasma proteins, and the rest are all these red and white blood cells. The liver creates most of these proteins, which include albumins, globulins, and fibrinogen. And when you give blood, or when you have you go to the doctor and they want to do a blood screen, you know, they take blood and they look at all these things. They want to know the levels of of albumins and globulins and so forth in the blood, because depending on where they're at, it could signify a possible pathological state or something going on in the body. The globulins are involved in your immune responses when the body is invaded by something foreign. Fibrinogen is involved with clot formation, so fibrinogen becomes fibrin when we're creating clots. Other solutes that we find here are electrolytes, nutrients, enzymes and hormones, gases and waste products such as urea, uric acid, ammonia, etc. And again, when your physician is asked the lab to take blood from you and phlebotomy, many of these things are looked at to see what if their ratios are appropriate or correct when we look at the blood, which again, depending on where they're at, could suggest that there's a pathological problem going on in the patient. The formed elements, there are three principal cells, if you want to call them that. There are red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. Red and white blood cells are whole cells, and platelets are fragments of what once was a whole cell. That's actually called a megakaryocyte. So it's a big cell that gets produced in the myeloid genus, I believe it's myeloid, and it fractures into these small little pieces. And again, it plays a role in clotting. Red and white blood cells are whole. The percentage of total blood volume occupied by red blood cells is called the hematocrit. So sometimes, again, if we're looking at someone who's anemic or suggesting they're anemic, again, they'll take blood and they'll count how many red blood cells and do kind of a mathematical equation to see if there's the appropriate amount of red blood cells in there. So what we're doing is we're looking at your hematocrit as to how much of the total blood volume is occupied by red blood cells. A hematocrit of 40 indicates that 40% of blood volume is red blood cells. Normal hematocrit percentages are 36% in females and 40-54% in males. And of course, because red blood cells carry oxygen, that represents the oxygen in carrying efficiency of blood at any given time. So when people are lethargic and they're not feeling well and tired all the time, it could indicate that they have a lack of red blood cells, which means that they are anemic. So a drop in your hematocrit indicates a condition called anemia, and a raise or an abnormally high hematocrit is called polycythemia. And polycythemia, these folks need to have that dealt with as well. So too little or too much is still, neither end is good. We want to maintain that normal hematocrit. When we have a high hematocrit, of course, then the blood would become more solid, right? The more cells we have, the more solid the blood would become. So polycythemia results in thicker blood with the potential of resulting hypertension and risk of stroke, because the heart has to start working to push around a more solid blood. Everybody knows who Lance Armstrong is? He used something called EPO, erythropoietin, which actually forces the body to produce extra red blood cells. Extra red blood cells equals more oxygen, which equals better performance in sports. Some cyclists also do things such as take blood from themselves, wait 30 days prior to a competition, and put the extra blood back in their body. Again, too much blood, too thick, the risks start to go up, but it does help with performance. Yes? Nope. Yeah, that would be a condition called polycythemia. They would actually suffer from polycythemia.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. All right. Now, certain things such as if we look at the Sherpa or those who live in the high Himalayas, they do have a greater percentage, but that's their adaptation to live in a low oxygen environment, living way up in the high parts of the earth, right? Yeah, it just gets too thick and it gets hard, right? Because just think about that. Yellow represents liquid, and everything below represents solids. So you just gets it thicker and thicker. So you can see here we have your red blood cells here, and then your white blood cells here. This is what I was talking about. So you've got your hemocytoblasts here, and they become either a myeloid progenitor or a lymphoid progenitor. So all the cells that we find in blood, which can be a basophil, neutrophil, eosinophil, monocytes, and macrophages, which represent white blood cells, or we can have mast cells, which are directly related to myeloid, which are an immune cell, and then your erythrocyte, which is your red blood cell. Then you have your megakaryocyte, which fractures into tiny little pieces to become thrombocytes, which eventually help with clotting. So from the myeloid progenitor, we can create all these cells, red blood cells to carry oxygen, white blood cells for invaders and attack cells, that kind of stuff, and then the megakaryocyte, which is involved in clotting. On the common lymphoid side, we have all these immune cells, natural killer cells, T lymphocytes, B lymphocytes, and so forth. We'll be talking about those. Okay? So most foreign elements of blood last only hours, days, or weeks. Of course, they constantly have to be replaced, therefore, right? White blood cells numbers are through negative feedbacks, red blood cells and platelets, the numbers remain constant through, right? Remember, red bone marrow does hemopoiesis, which creates red blood cells and so forth. So we're constantly replacing. White blood cells are variable depending on the needs and respond to invading pathogens. So if you go to the doctors and you go for a phlebotomy and they look at the cells in your blood, if you have high levels of white blood cells, that's indicative of an infection. That's what they look for, to say, oh, lots of white blood cells, something's going on somewhere. The formation of blood elements, as I said, is called hemopoiesis. Liver, spleen, thymus, and lymph nodes initially are the centers for hemopoiesis in the fetus. And then the last 3 months before birth and the rest of your life, hemopoiesis occurs in red bone marrow, which again can be found in flat bones such as sternum, scapula, the ileum of the pelvis, and so forth. Not long bones like the femur or humerus. Remember, they have white marrow in them, which does not produce red blood cells. Red bone marrow is a highly vascularized connective tissue. It's found in the bones of the axial skeleton, pectoral and pelvic girdles, and the proximal epiphyses of the humerus and femur. Within that, you have stem cells, and they reproduce themselves, and then stem cells, remember, are always undifferentiated. They don't know what they want to be yet. They will eventually differentiate, and they become cells that eventually will turn into blood cells, macrophages, reticular cells, mast cells, and adipocytes. So, again, a stem cell can be stimulated to become any one of those at any given time. Lots of chemicals, all sorts of things. It's quite the mechanisms, but this is why they're able to take a stem cell out of a patient and then through some of these mechanisms can turn that cell into what they want it to become to replace something that they're trying to do. A hormone produced by the kidneys called erythropoietin or EPO increases the number of red blood cell precursors, and that's what athletes are using to cheat. Kidney disease can lower the kidney's ability to produce this EPO, and then you end up with a decreased hematocrit. Another hormone produced by the liver called thrombopoietin stimulates the production of platelets. So, of course, if you're needing clotting occurring and damage, you will have the liver somewhat produce this other hormone, which speeds up the need for platelets, which is involved in the clotting process. A glycoprotein produced in red bone marrow called cytokines act as local hormones to regulate non-specific defenses, macrophages, which are the big eaters that will try to eat any kind of invader in the body, and immune responses, B cells and T cells. One of the things that happened with COVID, people were getting pneumonias due to COVID, and then they would whip their immune system up so high that it was called a cytokine storm, and you would get these cytokines that would just, there would be a prolific production of them, and then the immune system would literally come into the normal cells of the alveoli and eat them all up and destroy them. And then that would cause scar tissue, and then you'd start to see diminishing ability to exchange gases at the lung level because there was so much scar tissue due to all this immune destruction of this autoimmune invasion of your normal cells. Thankfully, it only happened to certain people and not to others, thank goodness. Red blood cells, of course, known as erythrocytes. Erythro, remember, is terminology is red. Okay. These specialized blood cells contain something called hemoglobin, which is the protein responsible for carrying oxygen. and it's the hemoglobin that makes the blood look red. So hemoglobin carries the oxygen when you have the exchange at the lungs. One drop of blood is approximately 50 microliters. Okay, so one drop of blood is 50 microliters. In 1 microliter, so a 50th of a drop, we find 5.4 million red blood cells in males and 4.8 million in females. Yeah. Yeah. We carry a lot of oxygen. We need to. That's our adaptation. That's what we survive on. So you have a lot of red blood cells in you. It's going to sound really bad by me, but what were we expected to do way back when? Hunt, run, chase, right? Yeah, we set up more for, so our skin is thicker, our pelvises are narrower, we have more red blood cells, we carry more blood, because evolutionarily, traditionally, that's what we did, right? We were out running, doing whatever, and not that we do that so much anymore, but it's still left over from the differences in the genders. To maintain the normal level of red blood cells, this will blow your mind. To maintain that normal level, you must create new mature cells at the rate of 2 million a second. You are producing 2 million red blood cells a second. Blow your mind. All right. It's crazy, right? So if you've got something called lymphoma, which is a type of cancer, it affects the myeloid strain of cell production, one of them being red blood cells, right, and white blood cells. So this is where when you get into these kind of leukemias and so forth, you start running into inability to deal with these. They don't happen. There's a couple of pathologies where a red blood cell normally lives 45 days. There's some pathologies where a red blood cell only lives 20 days, and that's why you become anemic. You're not able to make up the difference. So imagine you have a homeostatic relationship here, right, where you have red cells dying and replaced at a balanced level. Anything that causes that teeter-totter to tilt, right, you've got a number of different things happening here in terms of it. So, yeah, it's a lot. So we see here the shape of them, and we see them kind of traveling around. So because we have this concave on both sides, they're called biconcave. It's a result of the loss of the nucleus during its development. So a red blood cell does start as a normal cell with a nucleus and so forth, but then that nucleus dies off and the red blood cell specializes in being replaced with a hemoglobin, loss of nucleus to carry oxygen. That becomes its main role. This loss of the nucleus and this biconcavity results in a greater surface area for oxygen. The membrane is strong and flexible, and it needs to be because it could be squeezing through the capillary to try to get to the other side, right? In fact, what can happen is when they get old, they can possibly squeeze through a capillary and burst. It does happen from time to time. Due to the lack of nucleus and organelles, these cells don't carry on any metabolic stuff. They just carry oxygen, okay? They don't divide. They don't need anything, they just carry oxygen. The cytosol contains hemoglobin, which allows all the internal space to be available for oxygen transport. And each red blood cell has approximately 280 hemoglobin molecules in it. And it's hemoglobin that carries oxygen. So we can see here in this electron microscope, by the way, these are muscle fibers that we see here, with the vessel running through and the red blood cells traveling along the vessel to get to where it needs to go. You see this biconcavity here, and this represents a hemoglobin molecule right here. Now, this hemoglobin molecule contains a non-protein pigment called a heme. Now, heme is created from iron. So we need iron in our body to create a heme. So the hemoglobin molecule contains a non-protein pigment called a heme, of which there are 4 per hemoglobin molecule. And how many hemoglobin do we have? Approximately 280. So do the math. Come on, it's not hard math. There's 280 hemoglobin in a red blood cell times 4 equals... Correct. Okay, 1120. So, there's 4 hemoglobin per molecule. That means there are 1120 places where oxygen can attach to in a single red blood cell times how many million? We carry a lot of oxygen, in other words, right? We carry a lot of oxygen molecules. How many oxygen can each hemoglobin carry? 4 then, right? Therefore, each oxygen molecule that is picked up at the lungs is bound to the iron ion. At the tissue capillary level, this iron-oxygen reaction reverses, releasing the oxygen molecule. So the iron ion that's related to the hemoglobin is what the oxygen is attracted to when the red blood cell is at the lung and picking up oxygen. When the red blood cell gets out into the interstitial tissues peripherally, that iron releases the oxygen and it off goes the oxygen to supply the needs of the surrounding tissues. A hemoglobin also transports about 23% of the total carbon dioxide. The remaining is dissolved in the plasma or carried as bicarbonate. So hemoglobin carries all the oxygen to tissues, but it only carries a small percentage of carbon dioxide back to the lungs. The majority of carbon dioxide that's picked up at tissues travels back to the lungs in a different compound. It actually becomes a bicarbonate ion dissolved in the plasma.
So it releases
oxygen, a small amount of carbon dioxide, and the rest of the carbon dioxide basically travels in the liquid to get back to the lungs. Okay? So we see here, here's our hemi here with our iron, and we can see how the oxygen binds to it when it gets to the lungs. There is one compound that hemi's more attracted to than oxygen. Does anybody know what it is? There's a gas that hemi is more attracted to than oxygen. And if this gas is in the air, your hemi will pick it up and kick oxygen off. Carbon monoxide. Right. So what happens with carbon monoxide poisoning is that the hemi becomes so saturated with carbon monoxide, oxygen can't knock it off to get there. When these individuals do die from carbon monoxide poisoning, that's what color they are. The blood is so saturated with gas, it's so red, they look like a cherry. Yeah, because it's so saturated with blood. Red blood cell normally lives approximately 120 days. As the cell ages, the membrane becomes brittle. The cell potentially bursts when trying to move through a capillary and narrow vessels of the spleen. Macrophages in the spleen and liver break down the products of the cell, and all those are sent back to create new red blood cells, especially the iron. Man, we hang on to iron. It's like evolutionarily we seem to struggle with iron. So the body does anything and everything to maintain the levels of iron to create these hemis to be able to pick up oxygen. The body really works hard at maintaining iron levels. Globin and hemi are split apart, with the hemi further broken down to amino acids, which then can be used to create other proteins. So everything gets recycled. It's pretty cool how efficient with recycling the human body is. The iron is removed from the hemi portion and through a number of processes makes its way back to red bone marrow to be reused to create new hemoglobin molecules. Under normal conditions, erythropoiesis and red blood cell destruction occur at the same pace and everything works out and it's pretty good. Now, when we, just for FYI, for a clinical perspective, float around that's what clots. It's the pieces that get sticky and stick together and clot. Okay, lymphatic system. So along with the blood system, which we just finished, we also have an associated system called the lymphatic system. Have you talked much about the lymphatic system in lab? Not, no? Yes, no? Some, no? A little bit? Okay. So we see this as a whole other network of vessels. We can see them here. Everybody's heard of a lymph node, right? swollen lymph nodes you have in your neck when you have a bit of a cold or sore throat or something. Well, that's all part of the lymph system. And the lymph system is extremely associated with the blood system. So it is one of the principal systems that helps defend us against disease-producing microbes. So it plays a couple of special roles, one of which is to deal with any invasion of microbes the body has, whether that be a virus or a bacterial infection or something like that. It consists of a fluid called lymph, vessels called lymphatic vessels, which transport the lymph, a number of structures and organs containing lymphatic tissue, and red bone marrow where stem cells develop into various types of blood cells, including lymphocytes. Okay, so that sort of represents the system. What does it do? Its first is to drain excess interstitial fluids and return it back to the blood. When we look at the capillary system, we have the arterial system, we have the venous system. And as I said, you know, high pressure on the arterial side, low pressure on the venous side. When blood enters into the capillary bed, arterial side, and we said that those continuous capillaries were somewhat leaky, right? We had oxygen that left, but we also have nutrients, vitamins, minerals, and so forth that can leave. And along with that, we also have blood plasma, which eventually becomes interstitial fluid because they leak fluid. On the venous side, we know the carbon dioxide travels in. So too does some of the toxins or metabolites created as a byproduct of normal cell metabolism. And you would expect that the fluid that leaked out on the arterial side, would go back into the venous side to maintain fluid levels within the blood, correct? It doesn't. And there's reasons for that. So what leaks out of the arterial side doesn't equal what goes into the venous side when you were dealing with fluid. What we do have is a lymphatic system, and I want you to think of it as a shop vac. So what it does, it sucks up that imbalance of fluid out and not in and makes up the difference. So it is constantly taking the excess interstitial fluid that can't get back into the venous system and sucks it up, and that excess fluid travels through the lymph system to get back to the heart to maintain the appropriate volume levels of blood. Everybody follow me with that? Okay, so excess water out on the arterial side, we need the venous system or the lymphatic system to take up that excess that doesn't get back in. Okay, so this is where we say draining excess interstitial fluids and returns it back to the blood because the cardiovascular system can't maintain blood volume without it because it this unequal inability for that fluid to get back into the venous side after it's been released from the arterial side within the capillary bed. lymphatic system also transports dietary lipids and the lipid-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K that were absorbed through the GI tract. So when we look at the fats that we eat, they don't get picked up in the blood like some of the other chemicals or minerals and so forth in the foods we eat. The fat actually travels as a milky white fluid into the lymphatic system through specialized lymphatic vessels called lacteals. But ultimately, just understand the fat enters into the lymphatic system to be processed, not into the blood system. It also carries out immune responses. In other words, it initiates specific responses directed against particular microbes or cells. So, lymphatic vessels begin as lymphatic capillaries. So this lymphatic system is very similar to veins. They start small and they get larger as they get more proximal to the center of the body. They're closed at one end and located in the spaces between cells. The lymphatic vessels unite to form larger lymphatic vessels, which resemble veins in structure, but have even thinner walls than the veins and far more valves. The pressure of a nickel will move lymph through the lymph system. That's how little pressure there is in there and how thin the walls are. You're going to learn in semester two how to lymphatically drain someone. So how to move lymph out of tissue into the system to get back to the heart. But it's not like Vodder technique where you're actually trained at draining. That's for after you graduate, if that's something you're interested in. At intervals along lymphatic vessels, we have these lymph that flows through lymph nodes. So along these pathways back proximally, we have these nodes that the lymph travels through. So one side of the node it enters into, the other side it exits the node and continues traveling through a vessel. Lymph nodes are encapsulated masses of B cells and T cells. The lymph vessels generally follow veins. The lymph vessels of the viscera follow arteries, forming plexuses, networks around them. So they're closely associated. We can see here, here's our arteriole, here's our venule, here's our shunt here, and then we have the capillary bed here, and we can see how the all wound around it are these lymphatic vessels. Again, their responsibility, you know, soak up that extra fluid that comes out of this system. So we can see here we've got these little valves along the terminal ends here of the lymph, and through pressures they allow fluid in, and then of course when the pressure gets higher inside the vessel than outside, that pushes the valves closed until fluid lymph continues more proximally. Pressure goes down, the valves open again, because you'll have greater pressure outside the vessel than inside, so you have a net movement inwards by opening the valves. Pressure goes up inside the valves, close the valves, and so forth. You get it? And so it's basically cleaning it up. So the capillaries are slightly larger in diameter than the blood capillaries. They allow fluid to flow into them but not out, based on these one-way valves. So as I said, their whole responsibility is to suck up this excess fluid that comes out of the capillaries, and they have these one-way valves in them. The endothelial cells that make up the wall overlap, and when pressure is greater in the interstitial fluid than in the cells, these separate slightly, and the interstitial fluid enters the lymphatic capillary. When the interstitial fluid is less outside than in, the overlap's close tighter as to prevent the fluid to escape out. So, you know, these one-way valves are allowing fluid in ultimately, but they're not allowing fluid to leak back out. In the small intestine, these specialized lymphatic capillaries called lacteals, they carry dietary lipids into the lymphatic vessels and ultimately into the blood, where then that fat ends up in the liver to be processed and dealt with to get out to cells for energy and so forth, or deposited in those lovely places we think about. Lymph fluid is clear, pale yellow. So again, we can see it here. There is a relationship in around the capillary bed. We can see lower pressure inside, the valves open, fluid goes in. Lower pressure outside, the valves close and continues, and you can see it here as well. Here are your lacteals in the villi of the gut. So the lymph, same idea. It takes these liquid from the gut. Again, higher pressure outside, the liquid goes into the lacteal to follow the lymph system, and of course, less pressure outside, the valves close and so forth. It works exactly the same way, but instead with the lacteals, it's taking up dietary lipids, whereas in the fluids, it's taking up interstitial fluids. Now, as I said, they get larger and larger as they become proximal. So small capillaries to larger and larger vessels. So lymph passes from capillaries into lymphatic vessels, and then, as I said, through lymph nodes. Those vessels exit the lymph node on the other side, or they pass the lymph either toward another node within the same group or to another group of nodes. So what we see here is we've got all these groupings of nodes where lymph is catching, you know, running either through a set of nodes one place or another. Ultimately, think of a lymph node as a filter system, okay? So the lymph is made up of B cells and T cells, which is the immune system, and the filter part of the lymph nodes allows the lymph nodes to capture, say, a virus or a bacterium that's in the system. And then when we have a virus, say, in the throat, and we get the swollen lymph nodes in our throat, it's because those lymph nodes through the lymph system have captured the virus, and now the immune system is in a battle royale with the virus, hence the reason why the lymph node swells. So the vessels exiting lymph nodes pass lymph either towards another node within the same group or onto another group of nodes. From the most proximal group of nodes, exiting vessels unite to form lymph trunks. So where they come together are called trunks. The principal trunks in the body is the lumbar trunk, intestinal trunk, bronchomediastinal trunk, subclavian trunk, and jugular trunk. we can see them here, right? So we had the intestinal, bronchial, spinal. We can see them all sort of along here. Just so we have a groupings of large amounts of nodes. The thoracic trunk is the main trunk for return of lymph. So they all come together and form even a larger grouping. So thoracic trunk is the main trunk for return. It receives lymph from the left side of the head, neck, and chest, the left upper limb, and the entire body inferior to the ribs. So we see here the left side of the head is called the thoracic trunk. So everything in flesh tone here is the thoracic trunk. So both lower limbs, lower abdominal region, left arm, left thorax, left head, all drain into this area here. The right lymphatic trunk receives lymph from the upper right side of the body only. The right lymphatic trunk drains into the right subclavian vein. So the left trunk drains into the left subclavian vein, and the right trunk drains into the right subclavian vein. The flesh tone represents the left trunk, and the blue represents the right. There is a discernible difference in the amount of lymph each side takes in, isn't it? But that's just the way it is. So we have to think about pressures. Like I said, the valves open and close due to pressures, right? So, Starling's hypothesis. This involves four pressures and their influences on the movement of fluids into and out of the tissues. So we have to think about what's happening when fluid is moving into or out of lymph. So the first is called plasma hydrostatic pressure. The pressure inside the capillaries that decreases due to peripheral resistance as fluid passes from the arterial side to the venous side of the capillary bed. We already have talked about this quite a lot, right? So the arterial blood travels into the capillary bed, right? And we have this resistance that's happening as the fluid passes through, and pressure inside the capillaries, the blood capillaries, goes down. Okay, got that so far? Next, we have the tissue hydrostatic pressure. The pressure of fluid in the tissue channels, usually negative or atmospheric, that tends to pull fluid from the capillaries into the tissues. So we have reduced pressure of fluid in the capillary bed, but interstitially, there's less fluid pressure than inside the capillaries, okay? If there's less fluid pressure in the tissues as compared to the capillaries, in other words, if there's a bit higher pressure of fluid in the capillaries and lower pressure in the fluids, what's the net movement of fluid? Into the tissues, right? Lower out here, higher here, net movement from capillaries to tissues, okay? All right. Plasma colloidal osmotic pressure states that the pressure caused by plasma proteins that creates a siphon effect and pulls fluids into the capillaries. So the idea would be that in blood you have plasma proteins. So via osmosis, because there's greater plasma proteins in the blood than in the tissue, that would represent that fluid would want to then move from the tissue into the capillary. So we've got these other processes that are forcing fluids out of the capillaries, and we have a bit of things like osmotic plasma protein influence that's asking for fluid to come back in. Everybody follow me so far? Okay, coming back in. So we're like, nope. Okay, tissue colloidal osmotic pressure. Pressure caused by plasma proteins in the tissue that causes the net movement of fluid into the tissues. So all of these, Starling's, plasma hydrostatic, tissue hydrostatic, plasma colloidal, and tissue colloidal, determine how much fluid moves into and out of the tissues and the bloodstream. That's what that's all about. So things are either influencing fluid to leave the blood system and go out into the tissues, or for the fluid and tissues to leave the tissues and go back into the capillary. It's all based on things like plasma proteins, pressure of fluids, and so on and so forth, okay? So, the laws states that the fluids flow from an area of high pressure to an area of low pressure until equilibrium is achieved. We already know that, correct? We've talked about that a lot. When arterial blood enters the capillary, the fluid pressure is higher in the vessel as compared to the surrounding tissue. As the blood moves to the venous side of the capillary, pressures are lower in the vessel as compared to the pressures in the tissue due to peripheral resistance. So we start with a net movement of fluid out because greater pressure in the arterial side of the capillary bed, and then we'd expect to see a net movement in on the venous side as the fluid lost its pressure, and you have less pressure in the capillaries than you do in the interstitial fluids. Does that make more sense now? So, as the blood moves into the venous side of the capillary, pressures are lower in the vessels compared to the tissue due to this peripheral resistance. So therefore, you would think that fluids would move back into the venous side, but they do not, as there is dwindling filtrate across the capillary beds and no reabsorption into the venous capillaries. So even though those influences are there, lots of fluid leaves the arterial side of the capillaries, but it does not go back into the venous side. Okay? Tissue balance that thus depends critically upon lymphatic function. The initial lymphatic vessels take this excess fluid and drains it into the lymphatic system when that becomes lymphatic fluid, which is two things. One, it prevents edema of the interstitial tissue, right? But two, it also sucks up bad guys. So it actually draws viruses and so forth into the lymphatic system to deal with it there. Anybody here, got anybody in the family who's ever had a mastectomy and had a breast removed and lymph nodes in the axillary region? Anybody? But you know someone? And what happened to their arm? No, did they lose their breast and the lymphatic tissue?
Yeah.
Okay, did their arm swell? Okay, so all you have to do is remove a bit of lymphatic tissue, of lymph nodes in a particular area. Distal to that limb will collect fluid to immense proportions. Yes, lymphedema. Yes. What's that? It depends on how much lymph they take. If they do a considerable amount of removal of lymph nodes and lymph, then the limb has very poor drainage. So prostate cancer, mastectomies, those sorts of things where they have to remove lymph, you'll get massive lymphedema. Yes. Yeah. She has a glove on there. Does she go and see anybody for drainage? Good, okay. Because what happens is this ability for the lymph to suck up the excess water, it's not there. And how large can her arm get? Huge, right? You have no idea how much your lymph is maintaining that balance. It's incredible. As soon as you do damage to it, legs become massive, arms become massive, because there's no way to drain that excess water back into the system. Radiation can do it. Surgery can do it. Yeah, there's a few things that can do it. Most components of blood plasma freely filter through the capillary walls to form interstitial fluid. More fluid filters out of the blood than returns via reabsorption. The excess filtered fluid, 3 liters a day, drains in the lymphatic vessels and becomes lymph. So without the lymph system, you are in excess of 3 liters a day that can't get back in. Put 3 bags of water into your body. See how much it's going to collect. Yeah, because it sucks up that excess water, right? And that's the key part. That's probably the most important part. But the other part that's so cool is within that excess fluid that it's sucking up could be a virus that's invading your body, and then the immune system will utilize that to its advantage. Some protein does leave the blood at the capillaries but is unable to return due to the concentration gradient. These proteins are also able to enter the lymph system via these lymph capillaries and get back into circulation. So the sequence of flow is blood capillaries, interstitial spaces, lymphatic capillaries, lymphatic vessels, lymphatic ducts, subclavian veins. So ultimately, all that fluid we're talking about gets picked up by the lymphatic system and gets dumped back into subclavian veins to go right back into the blood. Right back in. The same two pumps that aid venous flow also aid lymph flow, skeletal muscle pump and the respiratory pump. So every time you breathe with your diaphragm, you are both milking the lymph system and your vena cava to pump both lymph and blood back to the heart. Every time you walk, every time you use muscles, skeletal muscles, you again are milking lymphatic vessels and veins to return blood and lymph back to the heart. There are lymphatic organs and tissues, so you do see them in the body. Primary lymphatic organs are where stem cells divide and become immunocompetent, so in other words, capable of mounting an immune response. The primary lymphatic organs are your red bone marrow and the thymus, but you lose your thymus after, I think it's 5 or 6 years of age, and we'll talk about the thymus next week. Stem cells and red bone marrow give rise to immunocompetent B cells and pre-T cells, and it's the pre-T cells go to the thymus to become immunocompetent. So B cells are called B cells because they arise and become mature in red blood cell, B blood, and T cells, red bone marrow, creates immature cells that have to go to the thymus to mature. Thymus starts with a T, so you have T cells. Both B cells and T cells are very much involved in your immune response. It is B cells and T cells that we are stimulating to prepare for disease with vaccines. It's vaccines that stimulate these B cells and T cells so that when that disease comes around, such as polio or whatever, the body already is immunocompetent to be able to fight it before it even makes you sick. And that's the whole purpose of them. Secondary lymphatic organs are where immune responses occur. This is your lymph nodes, your spleen, and the lymphatic nodules. So here's your thymus that you can see here. Spleen's down here in this upper left quadrant, and so forth. Okay? I guess we'll have to leave it there. Do we have a quiz next week? It's your last one next week, right?